Committee on Energy and Environment, Monday, 3:30 p.m., 27th of June, 1983, hearing room 343, Senator John Pitzhopper presiding. 3:30 work session on House Bill 2556 delays until January 1, 1986, sunset date for limited entry commercial fishing programs and other provisions. House Bill 2977, evacuation procedures in the event of a catastrophe or an accident. And the executive appointment of Lorna J. Stickle to the Water Policy Review Board. 4:30 hearing on House Bill 2625 permits counties to allow home occupations in any zone which allows residential uses. House Bill 2662 authorizes Board of Directors of corporations formed to deliver water to require prepayment for delivery. 5:30 work session, House Bill 2320A relating to energy. House Bill 2295 relating to land use, issues related to economic development, excluding American Electronics Association proposal, miscellaneous amendments listed as other on earlier handouts. The committee may take action on any matter previously heard by the committee.
Committee on Environment and Energy will come to order. We have some work sessions and some hearings. Let's have our first hearing on House Bill 2625. Have you explained the bill to us?
You should have a packet with a mock-up version of the bill as it came over from the House. And I've just sort of written in there what the changes were. You also have the amendments attached. This bill is
because... This is 2625, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
you see that?
Yep.
House Bill 2625 would allow counties to permit the establishment of what are sometimes called cottage industries in the bill. They're called home occupations in any zone so long as the business does not employ more than five persons not related to the owner and is operated within the dwellings or buildings normally allowed in that particular zone. House amendments to the bill also limit, the House amendments limited the number of employees to be hired to five, enabled rather than required the counties to allow home occupations, and limit the operation of the business to the dwellings and buildings normally associated with the dwelling in a particular zone.
Okay. Got a lot of constituents up here today. Paul Howard, here somewhere. I don't know where they are.
Did they sign up?
Yeah, but they might have thought the bill was going to be done at 4:30. I'll say, do we have a page?
Kev, could you and our
Why don't we, why don't you go down and get them, and then we'll have a couple work sessions here in the meantime. We'll temporarily close the hearing there until we get
questions
to start the day.
I don't see on the agenda the dam bill.
It is up on Wednesday.
If you're having trouble, I'll go down and explain them in my...
No, what I was trying to do is I wanted to make sure that the amendments were...
What you wanted?
Were what I wanted. Okay. I called a Pat in Montana to make sure the governor had any problems with them, and he doesn't, so...
Okay. All right, we will hear that. We'll try to get
that. That's it, up first off.
That's all right. What do you want to work on?
I would like to take action on House Bill 2977, which is the evacuation procedures bill. You recall the there are
ready to go?
Amendments to it. It is ready to go.
Yeah.
Amendments to it?
I thought we adopted the bill.
I think we did adopt them, though. But
Mr.
Are.
Chairman?
Senator Day?
So let the record show, I'd ask for unanimous consent to show that the amendments to 2977 from Legislative Council, House Bill 2977-2, dated 6/27/83, are formally adopted if there's any question on it. And I'd ask unanimous consent for that.
Objection?
Move the bill to the floor of the DuPass recommendation as amended, Mr. Chairman.
I'll accept the motion. Senator Day moves amended House Bill 2977 to the floor with DuPass recommendation. Todd, did you have one comment you want to make from council?
Yes, they said that the there was one amendment that was made, proposed by the people that came in with the bill in the first place, and it wasn't fully explained, and that was that the intent statement was modified.
Because they did no longer, they did not, but that's not going to be in the, it's not going to be in the statute.
There was one other change, and that is the section that was originally repealed deals with the governor's powers in the event that an area is declared, emergency is declared to exist. And council would like some leeway to be able to change, it says such area, and he would like to be able to put that in better context.
That's part of my original amendment.
So that recommendation in his motion. Okay, is there discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Day.
Aye.
Senator Hammond.
Aye.
Senator Strasser.
Aye.
Senator Powell.
Aye. Let's now take action on the appointment of Walter J. Stickle, Water Policy Review Board.
I'll move the appointment to the floor that we confirm the governor's appointment of Laura J. Stickle, and I presume we have the financial report is here.
Have it for you.
Satisfied, Alexander Sarkovich. I've just looked at it.
Most of it is NA.
Okay, that's my motion, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Day moves that the committee send to the floor a recommendation that we confirm the governor's appointment of Warner Stickle to the Water Policy Review Board for her discussion.
Well, she's a good appointment. If you aren't one of the truth, she looks like a dandy.
Talented, yeah.
Yeah. We may shake them up good, get some talent on there for a change.
Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Day.
Aye.
Senator Hammond.
Aye.
Senator Strasser.
Aye.
Senator Powell. Aye. So, Ron, some other questions,
Chairman. Yes, Senator.
When do you intend to take up the Ham Street appointment again?
We have discussed that with the department and with Pat, and he's going to come back, and we're going to try to have him come back on Friday to spend a little more time discussing some of the problems that people had and, give another crack at it. So we've got him on the schedule for Friday, and we're checking to make sure he can come.
Okay.
Let's see. We took care of that. Do we have anyone here on House Bill 2662? Okay. Well, Peter, where's the bill?
He's going to get in until 4 o'clock.
Till 4 o'clock.
I can go get him by the time he wants to.
Well, what I'm going to have to do, since they went and got those other individuals for that cottage industry thing, there's only two groups. I think we'll go ahead as soon as they get here and take that bill up first and then have your little presentation.
Shall we have?
So you might, I think we'll just be in recess for a couple of minutes here.
Okay, do it right now.
Well, just I think 4 is fine. Okay, so we'll be in recess for a few minutes. Senator Bradbury's got some amendments to turn. We've got, you all want to come up together in groups?
Groups of three.
Okay, let's see. Whichever group gets here first. See, we've got Paul. Paul Howard, why don't you and your group come up here first?
Okay.
Bill Scanlon. Chuck Adams.
Senator Kitabia, how would you prefer to proceed on this?
Why don't you just, are you just each going to speak to the bill? Why don't you just then identify yourself or whatever order you'd like and go ahead and make the presentation?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Charles Adams. I represent the Roseburg Area Chamber of Commerce. With me is Paul Howard of the Douglas County Chambers and also Council of Governments. And Phil Scallon, president of the Sutherland Chamber of Commerce. and past president of the Douglas County Chambers of Commerce. Approximately in December of 1981, the 12 Chambers of Commerce in Douglas County joined together all to form the Douglas County Chambers of Commerce. And the organization began its meetings in individual cities in our county to make tours to identify the diversity of our county economic base. Since the inception of the program, over 100 cottage industries have been identified in the rural areas which produce products and employ people. Cottage industries are normally started by retired or semi-retired people looking for a way to supplement their income. The beginnings of business normally start in a rural area garage or barn, and they expand as markets develop for their products. Most of these producing products cannot be identified because of violations in land use laws. It is our feeling that if cottage industries are to be encouraged to develop and expand and produce jobs from within the local economic base, that adequate provisions should be made in land use planning in the rural area for their protection. And it's our feeling that the House Bill 2625 is the answer to the development of cottage industries. We have a number of success stories to report as far as development of cottage industries go. As an example, we have a cut glass firm that makes glass for a variety of gift products that started in a barn in Camas Valley. Working with the owners of that firm, we relocated them to an abandoned lumber yard in Winston, and today that company employs 28 people and ships their products to 35 states. And within those 100 that we see developing in our county, I'm sure you can add considerably the numbers that would be developing in the state of Oregon besides those in Douglas County. We get a cross-section of products identified from springs and clips for the computer industry to satellite television antennas, modular phones, airplane parts, and on and on. We're sure that such cottage industries with adequate help from financial sources such as our Coos Curry Douglas Economic Development Association, the Umpqua Development Corporation, and our chambers will assist those eventually into moving into properly zoned industrial parks and expanding our economic base and producing more jobs. But in the meantime, we do need the bill that you're discussing today to make it legally operable for those business firms while they're getting started. We ask your consideration and support of the House Bill 2625. Thank you.
Thank you. Question?
Mr. Chairman? Do you have the bill as it's been amended, sir, in front of you, or do you?
Yes, I do.
Okay. The way I read this, of course, we're looking at an agricultural zone, or we're looking at a forest zone, where the obviously forest or farming is being done. As I read this, part of the criteria for the home occupation, and it doesn't restrict any home occupation would qualify, any, from a foundry on down. And then it says that they can use other buildings normally associated with uses permitted in the zone which the property is located. You took out any buildings going to be constructed. That was deleted. Sub C was deleted from Section 2. But the way I read that, they could almost build any building. You could have almost any building for a home occupation. Is that your intent?
Our intent is not to violate the rules and guidelines of LCDC.
Well, I appreciate that, but you see this bill, so you understand who passed this bill. We're giving a special exemption from the land use laws of the state. What this bill purports to do is to say anyone that wants to have a home occupation and employing five people or less can do that unfettered by any land use regulation in farm or agricultural lands. That's what this bill says. And on top of that, what it says is it says, well, at least I think it does, I have to check it further, it says you can do it in any buildings you want to build. I just wondered if that's your intent.
Well, I'm not aware that our intent has been to start the construction of new buildings for manufacturing plants in the rural area.
So your intent is not to do that?
Your intent is not to. Okay.
The intent is to be able to use existing...
Existing structures, existing barns, garages.
Okay, I just point out to the committee that the bill does not say that.
No, go ahead. Well, my name is Paul Howard, chairman of the committee. I work with the Umpqua Regional Council of Governments in Douglas County. I've done quite a few of the comprehensive plans for the communities. I've had a substantial experience in the land use planning business the last few years in Oregon. The reason I'm involved in this bill was the county chamber and I worked together the last year and a half or so putting together promotional information on Douglas County, and we sought ways to find local businesses and bring them out into the community so they could exchange ideas and viewpoints and maybe share inventions or machine tools and different kinds of things they've devised over the last couple of years. The problem being that many small businesses that currently operate in our area and other areas, I suspect, in the state, feel very, very protective of what they've established, and they're concerned that they do come out and become openly available to everybody, that they might leave themselves open to violation of land use laws and then be challenged because they've suddenly been found, so to speak. Most of our county planning staff realize those people do exist, and there hasn't been a significant problem. However, the businesses would like the protection or the feeling they have some protection, some recognition through some type of enabling legislation, and that's why HB 2625 was proposed initially, is to basically protect existing small businesses that operate in Douglas County and other areas. They're traditionally 2 to 3 to 4 people at the maximum, and they operate out of some buildings that are either on a farm or an older residence that has accessory buildings that are in most cases just renovated or remodeled to accommodate their needs. Very seldom is there new buildings or major expansion that we're aware of at this standpoint in time. We've just completed a tour of about over 40-some different cottage industries in Douglas County last year and a half, trying to find out who these people are and what they do and what kind of income they bring into the county. In most instances, I'd like to restate that they are using existing buildings with the exception of a couple new rabbit trees and things like that are very much agriculture-oriented, where they've had to build special buildings. But virtually all the small occupations don't fit into what you call traditional home occupation because they cannot be put into a residence or structure because there are some incompatible features if a person uses a welding operation or those kinds of things. But they work very well in accessory buildings once the accessory buildings are bought up to certain codes to meet fire marshal's requirements. Many instances those people are attempting to do that, but we don't have an adequate handle on that, and the county is thinking of probably instituting a license procedure to let these people come in, be recognized, and then deal with the planning and zoning issues on a more of an upfront basis rather than kind of going underground as they're somewhat forced to do right now. So that's my position, and I think we have a good proposal. I think maybe the counties can refine that some as if they get along and get some experience with it. Thank you.
Mr. Scott?
Well, I pretty well feel that we need a law similar to this because of the insecurity that a lot of the people have, and it has been said that probably 5,000 jobs are in an area that would be basically considered cottage industries, and you don't see it when you start driving down the road unless you're specifically looking for that. But I notice in just driving to work, and I drive about 12 miles every day, and I would say that about a third of the rural farm property that I go by have something that probably would not be considered a conforming business in it that would be farming. And I don't know how you treat a logger living on rural property, and he's got his equipment there and a shop to repair his equipment and things like that. But there's a lot of those areas that the people feel real insecure about, and they do a lot of things. And there's also a lot in the crafts area that are in the homes. And it's not only in rural areas, but it's also within every city that you want to look at. And that's another area where there is no way for these people to openly say, hey, here we are, because they're probably going to be in violation of some rule someplace along the line, unless that it is brought out in the open and say, here it is, and it's perfectly legitimate to a size of what you would want controlled.
Any other questions?
Mr. Day? You know, my statement says that we believe that the goal to achieve your aims here would be harmful to the environment because it intrudes upon forestry and agricultural lands. And that once it's established and you get, say, over 5 employees, it's pretty hard to argue to get it to move away. How do you feel about a statement like that? In other words, I get going, get my business going, it starts going real good. So I jump from 5 employees and I get up to, say, I'm going to go to 10 or 15. I simply don't have the capital to move it. It's lucrative. It's located there. And the choice of either shutting the business down or leaving it there, those type of choices given county government, particularly in this type of thing, and state government, are hard to make once the facts are in place. How do you answer that question?
Looking at the businesses in the past, and one of them that was referred to was the glassworks. They had 3 locations that they had operated in, but at the opportunity they had to bring it into an area where they could put the thing under a roof and brought it into Winston, why, they immediately done so. And I think this is the same thing that would happen in most all areas. People will move, but someplace along the line, if they're forced to move too quick, they're not going to be able to do it financially, and it'll create some of those other long-range problems we have. So
how do we know that? I guess that makes a good point, and I understand what you're telling me. But how do we know that the only criteria here is if 5 people or more? In other words, if they get over 5 people, what you just said is that we could have somebody that gets up to 100 people, and they still might not be feasible for them to move. My question of you is that when you see a business start to grow like this, the criteria here is 5 people. Once you exceed 5 people, well, I read this bill, you have to move, you have to go somewhere. My point to you is that opponents of this nature are arguing that once you allow this to happen, once you go over that 5 people, it's harder to get you to move because you're already established. You were just making a point, maybe we couldn't move right away because we wouldn't have the capital to move. I guess, why is the criteria of 5 people a very good criteria then?
Well, there's probably other reasons that only having it going to a certain size. When you start getting above that number, then the facilities that are going to be offered in going to a developed area are superior. Your costs get up into the area where they can afford to make the moves. Or going to be a 1 and 2 person operation in many cases, they can't afford the overhead of going into some of the industrially developed areas.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Any questions? Thank you. Gordon, do you want to say something?
Mr. Chairman, of the voting authority, Jeff Anderson, to come forward. Is there any assurance that primarily designated ag and forest lands are still going to be assured continued operation, even though there might be a cottage industry at the site? There isn't any language that assures that.
Maybe you could speak to that, Andy, since it came out of your...
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, could you repeat the question?
I don't see any language that would assure the continued farming forestry operation of the property that the cottage industry might be sited on. In other words, I'm certainly supportive of the notion of a cottage industry, but I would certainly not want to see the forest or ag lands.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hanley, that did not come up in the discussion over on the House side. I'd certainly be comfortable guaranteeing the continuation of farmer forest in the way of some type of an amendment. I'm entirely comfortable with it. Mr. Chairman, Senator Doe has brought up the question of the five people, and I guess the best way I can approach that is that this was an amendment that the department came in with, that they felt comfortable with five people as being a limit, because you have to draw the line somewhere. The cottage industry bill, I'm sorry I hurried over from committee, and I don't want to be redundant here, but it came to us from our Association of Douglas County Chambers of Commerce and Groups. They thought it would be nice to actually publish a directory of all our cottage industries, which there are a great number, and actually maybe even work it into tourism by having tours around. They immediately found out that these people were very fearful of this operation because they felt, and rightly so, that they were in violation of ordinances and land use laws. The counties themselves probably can do this. They've been fearful that they would not have their plans acknowledged if they had an ordinance of this type written into their land use plan. So this would make it perfectly clear to the counties out there. It's not mandatory, it's flexible, so you may develop ordinances to allow up to five people to operate in cottage industries. We tried to research this, the legislative research, and researched it extensively, and I guess because we have stringent land use laws, we couldn't find any other state among the 50 states that had any law in this regard. The country of Ireland, of course, is very heavy into the cottage industry, piecemeal work, this type of thing. They even went to the State Library and researched all the current laws of the State of Ireland and the country and could find nothing. So I guess you might call this Oregon being first and most or whatever to come forward with some legislation like this. It passed the House with very little opposition, and we think it's a good bill, and then I guess I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir Dave?
Do you think somebody should continue getting farm tax deferral if they open in a cottage industry like this?
Not on the buildings that themselves, if they know. Not farm related, they shouldn't have farm deferral on the
building. They ought to get to pay their normal taxes.
Certainly.
What I guess the five figure kind of is interesting to me, how the department arrived at that. I don't see them here, but I think it's curious because you could have a thousand branches arguing, obviously, in a letter to us. Have you seen their letter?
No, I haven't. They did not testify on the House side, so I...
Well, they're here in full splendor on the Senate side, and their argument is that once you get a business like this established, five employees, you get over five, and all of a sudden it may not be so feasible for an individual to move a business. Say they have six employees, because that's what, once they arrive at over five, you got to move, I guess, the latest buildings. You couldn't stay there. It could be argued, and I think some of the witnesses from Roseburg made the point, is it could be feasible if they couldn't move simply because they haven't arrived having enough capital to, you start at five, maybe it's 10 in some cases, maybe it's only two or three in others. It has to do with the volume. So this five employees figure is a little bit arbitrary. That's what you've always told me. this gentleman, Sandy Day, and I agree with arbitrary. I think it's the best figure that we can come up with. If it's law, it's written there, and you can't exceed that. I don't see any danger of county governor bodies attempting to break the law and say you can have 6 or 10 or 15.
What about the proposition? It's a little hard to move them away once they're established, but there they find some way to iron them in to let them stay there.
Well, Mr. Chairman, saying today, I don't see any way around it other than coming back to this legislative body to change the law.
We've been spending, in fact, you're working on a bill right now for marginal land, but we've been spending a lot of time talking about how we set the protections on forest land and agricultural lands, and that seeing urban Oregon move into more rural settings, it presents a lot of conflicts with the people who are trying to do good forest practices. They're just herbicides, use pesticides. Same true with farming, just general farming practices. It brings a lot of conflict to bear because you have a divergence of community living there.
Those would be more than would probably be needing. A series of small businesses like this individually don't make very much of an economic impact, but over the state, probably you get many, many of these businesses, each in themselves, with a few employees, and then when we think in terms of the products that they produce, as well as the jobs that they produce, it would make a big economic impact on the state of Oregon.
Thank you very much, sir. Questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify?
Mr. Chairman?
Okay, we'll close the hearing.
I'd like the department to testify on this. I'd like to make some inquiries on it. And,
okay.
The other thing, I see some other amendments here which are something the staff is looking at, which might be all right. The thing that it's hard for me to rationalize how we gear this with the 5 employee measurement, and I just got to think about that for a while, okay? It'd almost be better if you looked at sales or some type of income generated, because that's what we look at on tax deferral, but I just don't know whether that's, you know, makes any sense. I'd have to think it out with you, because we look at what things generate on a farm for tax deferral. So we look at something that's generated as a result of this and have employees as well as generation of income that ought to be the trigger. That's my thoughts.
Well, we'll put it up again for a work session this week, and we'll get the department in, and I'm also going to have some members back to clarify those 2 points that we discussed earlier.
Because I think they make a pretty good point. The only thing I'm concerned with is we start getting in these conflicts, and we've already been through them 1,000 times, and someone says, well, they told me I could go here, and then you arbitrarily set 5, and then I have 6 employees, now I'm done, and I don't have the capital to move, and...
Okay, we're going to close the hearing then on that bill, and I want to thank all of you for coming up here. We need to get some amendments drafted up, and we'll put it up for a work session this week and try to take action on it for you. I have a feeling we're going to be here at least another week beyond the earlier optimistic objections. I will call Chuck if that would be easiest, and let you know what the amendments are. Make sure we let you know what's going on, and we'll get that work session this week.
And Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I can hardly, I think you're absolutely right in your assumption we're going to be here longer.
Yeah.
And I need to know what counties prohibit home occupations, because I'm surprised that an individual who wanted to make tables, et cetera, out of work.
I think if you get into your situation, you come from an urbanized county where you got a lot of cities in here living, and it's less of a problem. You've gotten the more rural settings,
yeah.
And exclusive farming zones, so where it's pretty tight zoning. They started manufacturing stuff out there. I mean, you're gonna run afoul of the land use law. So there's a definite conflict here. And I know someone. think she's half her fingers going to resolve it. I don't think it's going to be that easy. So. In your area, they probably wouldn't have any problem.
Okay. We will next go to the work session on 2556. That's Representative Bradbury.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Bill Bradbury, State Representative, District 48. I'd like to start out referring first to the amendments from Legislative Council 2556-6.
Okay, just give us a second. We'll go through.
Sure.
I don't have a book. I have a book. Thank you.
Great. Bill's got a little fish show for us this afternoon.
Hey, such a fishy about it.
He's already just ready to show on. I'd like to first address the amendments 2556-6, which address some of the problems that were raised at the last hearing, specifically problems raised by Joe Easley from the Otter Trawl Commission and Ted Bugis. 2556-6 lines 2 and 3 eliminate the scallop and shrimp fishery from the provisions of the bill, which deleted the lottery for licenses. That was something that Mr. Easley said. We didn't think that we needed to delete the lottery for shrimp and scallops. That's what lines 2 and 3 effectively do.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bradbury. What amendments are you speaking to?
2556-6.
They should be hooked on here.
Okay, I've got them here, and it doesn't speak to about line 2 or 3 at all. All I have is proposed amendments, and it's 2556-6, and I'm thinking of the House bill dated April 21st, delete lines 6 and 7.
So that's lines 2 and 3. I beg your pardon, that's lines 2 and 3 of the printed amendments. I mean, the amendments, lines 2 and 3 of the amendments.
Five and those, please.
Yeah, it should be, well, it's of the amendments is what they've got here. It's lines 6 and 7 of the amendments.
Of the amendments, okay.
That's all?
Okay.
And then the other thing was that Ted Bugis wanted to clarify that the transfer provisions in House Bill 2556 applied only to ocean salmon troll fishery, and that is the effect, the other effect of the amendments contained in 2556-6, is to make that perfectly clear, that the limitations on transferring vessel permits only applies to the ocean salmon troll fishery.
You know, I'm Bradbury, I tell this to everyone that comes over here from the House. You'd make it a hell of a lot easier for us if you'd engross these damn bills before you send them over here, because we're having to deal with the printed bill as well as the amended bill to follow your amendments. And it's not your fault, but you're part of 59 others. And if you'd engross the damn thing, we wouldn't be here trying to sort them out. Okay?
Well, Senator Gray, I'm sure it's called being penny wise and pound foolish.
That's right. It makes a hell of a lot of extra work for us. And we're going to engross them anyway.
I agree. I mean, you got my support on that one.
All right. You've about to take care of that mess. We'll make a few comments, okay?
The other amendments I would like to speak to you today are 2556-7. And I've asked the committee staff to have distributed to each member a packet that looks like this. That's in yellow highlighting. They are in with your bill.
They're attached to, Mr. Chairman. I think you look at the back. I've been able to figure this all out. You know, so.
Okay. I'm up to speed, believe
it or not. This is basically adding a new section to House Bill 2556. It is not amending things that are currently in 2556. These amendments relate to private aquaculture and a desire to see private aquaculture treated equally with other producers of salmon and other harvesters of salmon in this public resource. So what I want to do just very briefly is speak to the legislative history of private aquaculture, which is what the first memo with the yellow highlighting is all about. And then show you a brief videotape that was produced by, I believe, Channel 6 on some of the problems that have cropped up with private aquaculture, and then they explain the amendments. Private aquaculture was first allowed, or first was proposed in 1971, and in the hearings on that bill, it was a very controversial bill, and in the hearings on that bill, there were a number of references made, basically continually there were references made to the fact that we could have private aquaculture without in any way damaging our existing native fish stocks. And if you look through this legislative history, you'll see over and over that statements were made that we could do this and that there were plenty of provisions in the law to provide for that. This was not an uncontroversial bill. As it was first introduced, it allowed private aquaculture to raise Chinook, Coho, Chum, and Chum salmon, three different species of salmon. There was quite a bit of opposition. I've included one letter from Mr. Dan Callahan, I believe his name was, who was from, the North Umpqua area. Stating his concerns about allowing private-for-profit aquaculture to get started in this state, and those some of those concerns are highlighted as well. The end result of all the concerns that were expressed was that in 1971, in allowing private aquaculture to develop in this state, they limited it to chum salmon only. They did not allow private aquaculture to move forward with Chinook and Coho. Now, Chinook and Coho are two of our major native stocks in Oregon, and chum is one that appears just a little bit on the north coast, but not very prevalent. And so the feeling was, in order to protect the Chinook and Coho from any kind of damage from private operators, they would allow the private operators to only operate with chum salmon. So there was a pretty strong concern early on to make sure that we went ahead and did private aquaculture. If we were going to move ahead, that we did so without in any way threatening the native stocks, particularly of Coho and Chinook. In 1973, the legislature, once the foot was in the door, the legislature opened that door a little wider and allowed private aquaculture to raise Coho and Chinook. There has been a rather rapid development of private aquaculture in this state, and this videotape will pretty well clearly show what kinds of problems seem to exist.
Yes, sir.
Could I ask you some questions first?
Certainly.
First of all, did you attempt to introduce the amendments on the House side?
Yes, I've introduced versions of these amendments on the House side.
And they were not accepted by the committee?
That's correct. They were heard in my House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee.
Secondly, could you help me understand how anyone involved in aquaculture can ensure that an adult salmon swim the right direction? Help me understand that, please.
Well, I don't think these amendments speak to them swimming in the right direction.
Well,
they speak to them returning to the estuary at a time that other fish come back and at a size that other fish come back. Both of those are perfectly possible if they used fairly normal hatchery practices, they would produce fairly normal fish. In fact, some of the private operators today are returning fish at a time and size comparable to public hatcheries because they are rearing fish in a method that is comparable to public hatcheries.
Does your tape speak to that?
Not particularly, I don't think.
I've never seen it.
The tape?
Okay.
Sandwiches.
dealt with in that videotape. In looking at the specific amendments, basically what they say is that private aquaculture fish, it would be in the best public interest for private aquaculture fish to return at a time and at a size comparable to those returning to public hatcheries, number one.
Thank you.
And number two, that these private hatcheries pose no greater risk to the native runs than do public hatcheries. This is considerably changed from earlier amendments that have been proposed, in that it very clearly accepts that these hatcheries have a contribution to offer as long as they can offer that in such a way that their fish return at a time and size comparable.
Yes, sir, Dave.
Didn't we have a fish fire over in the house on this issue?
Yes, indeed.
Was it lost?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Are these amendments to try to resurrect it?
They certainly keep the issue alive, and I think they are to address the concerns that were raised in a manner far more, what I would consider far more moderate than that was raised in the House Committee.
As I understand, the intent of these is to basically use the same standard for public and private hatcheries, but you have changed this from the House version in that essentially you recognize the legitimacy of private hatcheries as a contribution for fishery.
That's correct. And essentially we're saying that we're trying to define the public interest so that the private hatchery fish contribute and are treated the same as public hatchery fish. That's what you find in subsection A. I've had meetings with Fish and Wildlife where we've discussed why can't private aquaculture fish be included in the production indexes and the harvest allocations just like all other fish. And they say they can't because they're different. And I think it is certainly in the best public interest that if they're going to be in public water and they're going to be public fish, they should be subject to the same kinds of allocations that public fish are.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir, Dave.
Well, I have a little trouble with that because if you look at your amendments on page 7, you almost, and I understand all the, you know, when we play with these environmental conditions, we lay down some standards, and you're saying to ensure, he says, to ensure the hatchery practice of the permitted do not pose a risk greater than that posed by public hatchery practices of depletion or genetic degradation of any natural or anadromous fish, or any population of resident game fish. With that. How are we going to show that? How are you going to show that, Dr. Perez?
Well,
there could be a depletion, and you still would be faced, and I guess the private hatchery would be out of business if that depletion took place, and they couldn't show, if the burden would be to the private hatchery to show that, wouldn't
actually, the burden of proof in this operation, this is a section of the law, 508.720, which has to do with the alteration of permits, and the burden of proof is on the Fish and Wildlife Commission to show that the risk is greater. Because the Fish and Wildlife Commission would have to initiate any action in this instance.
Well, my relief hides you from that part, Mr. Chairman. You look under 720.71, and you start out with it's in the best public interest, and you lay out A and B. I'm not sure that you haven't shifted that burden of proof, and that's what bothers me, Representative Bradbury.
Senator Day, I would refer you to sub 2, move sub 2, if the commission finds that the operation described in the permit is not in the best public interest. There's a very clear role for the commission there, and they have to find what is in the public interest.
Mm-hmm. And then you make a shelf. They've got to act. They can't make an in-between decision. Is that correct?
It seemed to me that if they find something is not in the public interest, they certainly should be required to act to try to mitigate those difficulties.
Mm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions for Representative Bradbury? This is, it seems certainly has, I think, raise the controversial questions involved with this, and the primary opposition to this, these amendments are primarily from the Weyerhaeuser or Aqua Plant. No question about it. We have to inform the representatives of the hearing on these amendments. I guess my concern is that I recognize the legitimacy of private aquaculture in making a contribution to Oregon's fisheries, but I do believe that given the difficulties that we're having with fish runs, for example, fish runs in general in the state of Oregon and the importance of this industry, that it is not unreasonable to require the same kinds of standards and risk factors for both operations. And I guess that's the policy question. And I would move the amendments 2556-7 for discussion.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to oppose amendments for a couple of things. I don't think that we've already said yet on these private hatcheries versus public. I think that what you're doing by the adoption of these amendments are threatening what private hatcheries we do have. I think a great deal of money has been invested in that effort, and I think this controversy has been well aired in the House, and I think it bodes ill will to try to interject it at this late date, so I'm going to vote no, and probably serve notice of a minority report in on top of it, so you know.
Let me just get one thing here. But part of your opposition is that this was already done in the House.
I think that this whole controversy has been
I would say the same argument could probably be applied to some amendments that are going to be suggested to a bill. It's all worth the text. So I think we can be consistent here.
I didn't say that it was not germane. I just said the arguments. I don't think if you can get it passed, I don't think you can rule on germane. The question you were raising or someone raised that it wasn't germane, and I'm not sure that that's the case. The Senate can do magic things, I think, with any bill they want to. I'm just saying I don't think we need another fish fry, particularly when the private corporations have put a good deal of investment in it. And I just don't think that they've made the case that we ought to go about starting to meddle in the private hatcheries. I don't think we should. Now, that's my opinion. So,
well, I appreciate that. And that's certainly one side of the issue. And I guess I feel that this is not imposing an undue burden on private aquaculture. Most of those operations currently bring their fish back to the estuaries at the same time and the same size. And
well, I guess I don't see Weyerhaeuser here, or that they had an opportunity to testify.
Weyerhaeuser has been apprised of this work session.
Well, the work session with the amendments.
The amendments are very well aware of the amendments. Is there further discussion? Quick call roll.
Senator Day?
No.
Senator Cohen?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
No.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Senator Stankovich?
Aye.
Senator Kassav?
Aye.
Move also the amendments HB 2556-6, which are the ones that were agreed upon by the Oregon Trawl Commission and the Scallop.
The Otter Trawl Commission and the Gill Netter is represented by Ted Bugis.
Right. Okay. Is there objection to the adoption of those amendments? So ordered. Then move to amending the House Bill 2556 to the floor to pass recommendation. Quick call roll.
Senator Day?
No.
Senator Cole?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
No.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Senator Stargate?
Aye.
Senator Kassav?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, I serve notice of minority reports. Senator Hamby has agreed to join me.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Bill. Let's see. Now we're all in the work session on House Bill 2320.
Well, Mr. Chairman, for Todd's benefit, the minority report will just contain the bill as it was amended with -6 less -7. Okay?
Great.
Following?
Okay. All in the active proof cleaner.
22 what?
2320.
Oh, that's
exciting. Excuse me. Representative Jones, Chairman Swire. Hearing on House Bill 2662. Yes, Mr. Speaker, that I have Representative Jones step up here. So quiet over there. I'm not used to quiet people on my committee room.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This is quite a quick little bill, hopefully. ORS 545 will allow irrigation districts to refuse to deliver water to their members if they haven't paid their assessment dues, such as ditch cleaning and so on. However, Chapter 554, which applies to corporations, does not allow that. That's all this bill does, is put the corporations under the same statute that districts are under. And as an example, we have a small corporation owning a ditch on the Mount Hill River. There's about 15 people involved, and one man won't pay his assessment. They can sue him, of course, but then you've got to go to court and so on. And this would put it under the same provisions that an irrigation district is under and allow them to withhold the water until they fill their assessment dues.
Are there questions?
By the way, Mr. Chairman, this number was used with the consent of the original sponsors of the book.
Okay. Thank you very much for this question.
Thank you for your
support. Thank you for this week. Okay, we'll close the hearing.
I've got a potential conflict, Mr. Chairman, on this bill. We vote for it. I represent the water district employees.
Please don't forget that.
Close the hearing and move then to work session on House Bill 2320. Okay. I understand you have some amendments in there.
Yes, I do. Kevin, you're right. I have two sets, but the set that I wish to discuss is 2320A-6. Here's a set right here. I offered that set before, which was, I'll give you the former number, which is not what I wanted. 2320-7.
We have both
8-6 and 7 have to go. Both of them?
We have both of those in.
Yeah, but 8-6 is the one that I believe it was.
8-6 would just apply to plants with production capacity of 2 megawatts or less.
Yeah, okay. So 7 is the one I want to address. Okay.
7 is.
Alright. I have a new set I'd like to pass out, and Mr. Chairman, -8.
Well, you're initial.
No, I'm going to
learn to do the 8 of them.
Yes, I withdraw 7 and I want to do 8.
Okay. You have those coming down.
Yeah, I've got to come right down to my name on it. We've had so many amendments on this. 6 is something that we can look at in a minute. But 8 is what. If I may, I'd like to have Mr. Brown at Pacific Power and Light. Will you come up here, please, Mr. Brown?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, can Mr.
Yes.
Brown come up to where I am? It just strikes me, to the rest of the committee, that it just doesn't seem fair to me that we would not address this statute, 610, is, in my opinion, almost confiscation of property without compensation. And so we've dealt with various amendments. I discussed this with the utilities, and -7 we've fooled around with, and they discussed it with various committee members, and 8 is a product of those discussions. And so that's where you at least could address this in a way that would suggest that at least just compensation would be arrived at, or a reasonable value, not construction costs less
straight-line depreciation as we have testimony on, and I think this starts to address it. Mr. Brown, maybe you would like to just take us through, if you would, please. Mr. Chairman, if you'll indulge that, I would appreciate Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dick Brown, representing Pacific Power and Light Company. You'll recall when we had the public hearing on this measure, the testimony of Tom Nelson, who was an attorney for our, representing our company, talked about the 543-610 ORS that allows for a state or municipality to offer 2 years' notice to someone having a licensed project, and after the two-year notice, then being able to take over that project. At the original cost less depreciation, naturally, we wanted to repeal that entire section because we feel it's unfair. It's a section that is being used against our company at the present time in the on the Umpqua River. However, to be honest with you, we didn't have the votes to repeal the entire section. We feel that it's still unfair. We feel that if you cannot see a way to repeal the section by placing this amendment onto 2320, we would hope that you would at least repeal the portions of the ORS that says not exceeding the net investment as defined in ORS 543-010, or, and down below, the net investment shall be determined in accordance with the provisions of ORS 543-010 to 543-620. These provisions, of course, are the ones that say that the compensation would be net investment less depreciation. I think we're going to be up front with you. We hope that we can see, you can see your way clear to vote this amendment and take it to the floor of the Senate. It's fair. We think that we it's something that can pass the Senate and can be taken back to the House of Representatives for concurrence.
Mr. Chairman, whenever you get ready to accept motions, I'll make them, but I'll wait until I want to set a chance.
I'm going to move dash 8.
I'm not going to move the other, so my intention is to move on that.
Okay. Ms. Byrd, do you feel there's some value to the bill itself?
Yes, no doubt about that. Do we feel that?